Hey there, my name is Dan.
My name is Joshua,
and we are the Unauthorized Critics Circle. Now, Joshua, tell the listener what we do here at the UCC.
With pleasure. Here at the UCC, we review theater
with the normal bitcheries and qualms
by watching the video recordings
from questionable origins
of various productions. This week, we are talking about King Kong the Musical, specifically the Broadway production's performance in May 2019. If you're in the know, you probably have this recording. And if not, anything you find on the internet will pretty much be able to inform you about what this show is. We mention this because while we talk about the show itself, we also discuss the specific performance we've seen.
The internet is a long-lost jungle friend, but they're still here for you.
All right. Without further ado, the curtain is now rising.
Beat your chest if you love gorillas.
Please enjoy our discussion of the Broadway production of King Kong.
Roar!
Ugh. All
right.
Hey, Dan.
Are you... Dan? Dan?
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh.
Oh,
uh-huh.
You're there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is going on your end? What is that noise?
Oh, I'm warming up, like I always do, for each episode.
Jesus Christ, this is your warm-up?
Yes, this is my... What did you think I was doing?
Something healthy, maybe? This doesn't sound like... This just sounds like Nodes O'Clock. How often have you been doing this?
Every episode, I don't have notes.
Wow, explains the singing, I guess.
Fuck off! Fuck you! This doesn't work! You didn't lead it in the correct direction, and you know it!
I disagree with you. I firmly disagree with you.
You know you didn't lead that in the correct direction.
Welcome back to the Unauthorized Critics Circle. So... One of the things that Dan and I are able to bond over, one of the amount of things that I could count on a single hand, I'll say, is that we both have a really specific affinity for puppets. I know both of us have very, very strong Muppet backgrounds. We have spent hours conversing our own Muppet Dreamcast of properties.
What do the Muppets have to do with puppets?
Well, the names just sound similar.
The names do sound similar, but no, like... Miss Piggy is a first-rate artist. What does Miss Piggy have to do with puppets?
I'm not ready to have the Santa Claus conversation about the Muppets with you right now.
Did they do a TV special with Santa?
Oh no, you're so far gone.
Well, I don't know why he brought up the Muppets, but you know, everybody loves puppets, as they say.
And so because of our shared affinity of puppetry...
The world has an affinity for puppetry.
We both wanted to talk about puppetry on Broadway. We wanted to look at a show that featured puppetry. And what better show to pick than a show that in 2019 was given its own dedicated special Tony Award for its puppetry? Of course we are talking about the 2018 Eddie Perfect musical King Kong.
And after seeing the show, I question what is his kingdom.
The intersection between puppetry and Broadway is one that I regularly find myself very interested in, and so we
I ran for Flahooly. Flahooly.
The Hooly.
Flahooly. Flahooly. It was a puppet musical on Broadway with Barbara Cook. Only, there's no bootleg. So
I've actually
that was
never
off
heard
the
of
list.
That.
Mm-hmm. The Bill Baird puppets. Yes, right. She did a
well, I guess
puppet
that,
show on Broadway.
With that being off the criteria,
with
we
Emma
went for
Sumac.
Some... We both kind of agreed that we're not totally sure what the Avenue Q conversation looks like in 2022. And so
this
we've
is true.
Decided to go for some much more safer subjects, a much more calmer pieces of material, that being a murderous gorilla.
As one does. As yeah. one does.
But hey, at least there's not the xenophobia.
Well, look, I said we couldn't do Avenue Q because the entire episode would be Joshy doing his puppet voices from Avenue Q.
I don't have Avenue Q puppet voices.
I have a recording of you singing My Girlfriend Who Lives in Canada that I will put in the episode. Oh, okay,
well, you know what? A Rod voice is easy enough. I mean, like, a Rod voice. You're just sort of putting it up in the nasally thing. And then, of course, you know, I guess you can do his roommate Nikki as well very easily. And then Princeton's just sort of like, you know, this regular old Joe Schmo puppet voice that I guess you can
talk about the lines that you put on your face.
Trekkie Monster voice also very easy.
No.
I did. This is probably, I think, the most Avenue Q conversation. We can air all our Avenue Q thoughts here right now. Why not? I did Avenue Q in middle school as part of a summer camp. Isn't that great? Avenue Q, it was some kind of 60-minute truncated version. Extremely unofficial.
The internet is for porn. Right?
My social life is online. That is the actual Avenue Q school edition version of the song, which I think is actually funnier than the real thing. But they cut the entire Rod is gay subplot. Rod never kicks Nikki out. Gary Coleman was replaced by Justin Bieber and rewrote a whole verse in It Sucks to Be Me, which did not rhyme. So I took it upon myself to rewrite the verse so it did. No one asked me to. That's middle school Joshua. And the thing was, we didn't have...
I don't think you've changed as much as you think you did.
I'm not saying I have either. I'm just saying that's where I was.
And change comes slow.
Here's the thing. Avenue Q, of course... How do I phrase this? We didn't have puppets.
A puppet show without puppets?
Sort of... Yeah, the actress sort of just played the characters. I believe Kate Monster's costume was literally a Cookie Monster t-shirt.
Oh, no.
That's a reality fuck right there.
Oh, no.
They signified characters that were puppets by giving them lines down the corner of their mouths akin to marionette puppets, which was really fucking terrifying. And here's the thing. I'm a commit or don't guy. And so... To me, Princeton the puppet wears an Argyle sweater and has orange felt for skin. So I got the marionette lines on my face. I brought my own Argyle sweater that I had in my closet. And I insisted that they paint my face orange. No other person playing a puppet had their face painted. I was the only person on stage with a painted face.
You forgot the lead, though. You also insisted that someone stick their whole hand up your ass
okay.
for the entire show.
Okay, middle school Joshua Dan, please. Anyway, all that to say, we're probably not talking about Avenue Q on the podcast.
But we are talking about puppets.
We talk about puppets. And so, without further ado, we are of course talking about the beloved smash hit success musical... King Kong, which played at the Broadway Theater. Let's, bite the bullet. Let's get into it. I'm so curious to ask you what you knew about King Kong before.
Okay.
This. What's your King Kong history overall? Let's start general and then get to the musical.
Yes. So, King Kong was actually one of my dad's favorite movies when he was growing up. He showed me it at a very young age. And so... I've seen the one from the 1930s. I saw the one with Jessica Lange in the 70s. I saw the Peter Jackson King Kong movie from, what was that, 2006? I saw the Kong Skull Island, and we recently had Kong fight Godzilla. And that furthered the Hollow Earth
Kong's
theory.
A pretty argumentative guy, huh?
It's a story that gets retold and retold and retold.
I guess, but just like you never hear about anyone getting along with King Kong. You know?
I forgot about... I've seen Son of Kong that was made a few years after the 70s one with Jessica Lange, where King Kong found a large gorilla girl.
Oh my God. They had
a nice gorilla relationship.
Well, that's good. I'm so happy to hear that.
So I'm very familiar with King Kong. And I remember when the musical was first announced in Australia... That's a bad Sorry. I would like to apologize to the people of Australia. I don't really have an Australian accent, and I don't know why I just started.
Not all of us can so quickly step into an Australian accent. It's very much an acquired skill, and I wouldn't put it...
Anyway, they were doing a musical in Australia, and there were some mixed reviews, and then they were bringing it to America. And they knew they had to do some rewriting. So who did they call? They called none other than Jason Robert Brown and Marsha Mason.
Yeah, they did.
And I remember clearly the second that was announced, I sent around a group of texts like, I can't wait to hear King Kong sing about how he's having an affair with someone else. Very slow-moving ballad. This is going to be terrific.
A slow-moving ballad and immediately preceded by...
Yeah, I mean, it's a certainly active piano part for King Kong. And then they dropped out. And I remember Marsha Mason saying to the press at the time, we've hit an impasse at what the musical should be, and I don't know what you do when your leading man can't speak or sing. And still somehow the show came to Broadway, and they got Eddie Perfect.
In his first Broadway
songs,
credit.
I guess we can call them songs. He had two musicals running at once. Let's just...
And these are his only two so far.
I need a moment of silence. For Broadway.
Oh, my God. Because, I thought you were just asking me to shut up.
No, I need a moment of silence for Broadway because Eddie Perfect having two musicals running at once and there's not a decent song in between both of them. What the fuck, people? What the fuck?
Listen, we'll talk about King Kong, but I was listening to a song from the Beetlejuice cast recording came upon my shuffle recently, and my response to it was, God, I should really listen to this cast recording again.
Oh, break my heart.
We'll talk about this score, but there is a difference between the two. And I find the Beetlejuice cast recording very, very, very enjoyable.
I will be honest on my end. Haven't listened to the cast recording.
Okay, so what the fuck are you saying there's no good songs between the two?
Because I saw the Tony Award performance of Beetlejuice and I said...
You saw one adapted version of a song.
I saw the Tony performance. I said, I can't stand whatever Alex Brightman is doing. I can't stand the sound of that. This sounds awful. I want to kill myself, and this has only been 5 minutes. Why would I subject myself to more? Oh, I'm sorry. I could barely get through the Tony performance. I cannot imagine I would listen to that cast recording and come out being any more positive.
All right.
And I have seen more of Eddie Perfect's work now, and I can say... I still believe very firmly I would not listen to that cast recording and come out being any more positive. Knowing my history with Eddie Perfect, which, let's talk about that last name, you have to change it. Thank you. You wouldn't blame me.
Jesus.
What did you know about King Kong?
I recorded the original movie on Turner Classic Movies. Mm-hmm. I watched the first 20-30 minutes. I paused it. After about a week, I deleted it. Because I felt absolutely no inclination to go back and continue it.
You didn't care about what Kong looked like? You didn't want to see the Kong puppet?
I couldn't get into the movie. I wasn't interested. I don't know what I was. Maybe I'll give it another chance sometime, but it did not hook me.
Well, that's
but
a
in
shame.
In any case, when it comes to the musical itself, I was in New York when this was playing. My first time ever in New York was May 2019.
And you didn't get a ticket?
No, I got a ticket to the other Eddie Perfect show. I remember walking past the marquee a lot.
How many Sondheim musicals were playing at that time?
2019.
We had Eddie Perfect and no Sondheim.
They had Beautiful at the Sondheim.
This is even worse. Broadway,
yeah. Yeah, what can you do?
Cry for Broadway. Pour one out for Broadway.
In any case, I was on Broadway. I remember walking past the theater and actively going like, can't believe this show is here.
I forgot to tell you. I used to get all kinds of emails. Take this survey about what the surveys were. Shows that were considering coming to Broadway. What are you interested in? I would also get marketing emails. And I don't get them so much anymore, but I used to get them a lot. And I helped create, hypothetically, I helped create ad campaigns for Company. I helped create an ad campaign for Tootsie. I also got...
Oh, God, you enabled Tootsie?
I like taking surveys. They ask people opinions. I am not one who is short on opinions. So you give me a chance to give an opinion, I'm gonna take it. I also remember picking out King Kong artwork. King Kong flopped because they didn't go with my poster.
There we go. Yeah. That's what I was waiting to hear. Yep. Yeah. I don't want to be the one to say let's start talking about King Kong, because I don't totally know that I want to start talking about King Kong.
Let's start talking about King Kong.
Thank you. Okay. That made me feel better.
Where do we start?
Again, I'd kind of prefer not to, but if we must...
And we must.
And we must. We've signed this contract. Let's start material? How did you like the material?
I didn't. Next question. How'd you like the material?
Oh yeah, there was material.
Mm-hmm.
That's my overall thought.
I'm trying to devise a plan here.
I'm gonna start by saying this. I don't know if I've ever seen a filler musical like this before. Where
you have, well, maybe you haven't. I don't
like
know
this,
shows you've seen.
Like this.
I certainly have.
We talked about one of the shows that we've most disliked on the podcast is Diana the Musical. That's a musical that both of us very much disliked,
which apparently everyone went nuts for. And
we're not going to go into the controversy right now. I do not want to spark the ire.
I'm sorry. We had to judge what we saw on Netflix, and even if the cast started playing up the comedy in the theater when an audience was in front of them, the material still sucked ass.
Anyway,
we'll leave it at that.
What I mean to say about Diana is that
we stand behind our reviews.
With that show, the problem that I had with it was that it was poorly written material. I didn't think...
Boring.
Boring was also a problem. But for me, it was really just the fact that it was so unabashedly poorly written. And it felt extremely lazy to me, but it felt like they were trying to write something and just had absolutely no metric of what their quality was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from my experience with King Kong, which to me felt like an entire musical where everything written was incidental. Where it really was just like, okay, let's write a song for this story beat of King Kong and redo this scene from King Kong, from like the King Kong story as we all know it, from the way that the story's told or whatever.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of the story was rewritten. And I have a lot to say about that later on.
It's a lot of the same beats, though, isn't it? You get to Skull Island, you find the gorilla, you captivate it.
The larger beats are the same, but they got rid of so many characters, and they got rid of so much intention.
Well, getting rid of is one thing. I'm saying just generally, that also kind of speaks to what I think I'm saying, which is the fact that, again, it's just, hey, let's slap the story together. Let's create the, I guess, artifice of the story and just write some music that sounds like it'll go with it. Even though that's not what they did, but still.
Yeah. Okay. We need to point that out.
Yeah. I don't know. I would want to sit the creative team down and honestly ask them, like, what are you saying with this show? What is the point of having made this show? Or not having made the show, but having written this show.
You would sit the producing team down rather than the creative team, because I think the producing team is who ended up calling the shots here. And
oh,
I can see, yeah, I can see where their thoughts went and what they thought they needed. The actual writing of the piece isn't very good, but I can understand why they made the decisions they made. Whether or not I found those decisions worked, that's a different matter.
I don't know. It didn't feel to me like there was any thought behind anything here. Like,
well, I guess let's start here.
Mm-hmm.
So much as an authorial voice can be defined in a musical, and to say so much as Fosse is an authorial voice on just about any Fosse show, whether or not he was one of the writers. I think other people have determined it or called it the muscle. Who's the muscle? Who at the end of the day is going to make the decisions? Did there ever feel like there was a single authorial voice to King Kong?
No.
I agree.
Not to me. I don't...
I agree. There was no authorial voice. There
Maybe
were
that's where I'm
of...
feeling that flimsiness, possibly.
Yeah, there were a series of decisions that were made in response of this is how we think we get a hit. But there was nothing that was artistically leading the show. And it was a hodgepodge of styles, designs, and ideas that never meshed. And this very easily leads us into, if we can drop format for just a second, we have this opening number, and it starts, and it's like the chorus of Hadestown. is the easiest thing for like the first 30 seconds, and then it settles into a very synthetic rock that is specific to musical theater.
Yeah.
And it doesn't ever feel authentic, but it feels like this is what someone decided rock music is in musical theater, and they don't actually understand rock music, and they really just listen to Rent. And then we're raised in a BFA program, and this is what the voices around them could do. Like, I don't know how we landed on that is the synthetic rock musical theater sound. That needs to be investigated in and of itself, and that's probably a completely different episode that isn't even connected to a show.
Yeah.
But it's very generic. Nothing defines it. And doesn't seem like there's much craftsmanship. And then these people walk out in period costumes. And there's some lovely choreography that also kind of feels period to the 50s. And I'm confused because if you're going for this new rock musical theater sound that is very much based in 2007 and has not evolved past 2007. But if you're going for that 2007 pop rock sound, why am I then seeing period costumes? Like, why are we not creating an overall, I don't know, steampunk is overused. And the word steampunk is overused. I don't even know if steampunk is what I mean to go for. But why are we not putting a twist? Why are we not creating one world and one time period this show exists in? So from the very jump, we're having conflicting time opinions and conflicting styles between the music and the visual and the choreography.
And unrelated is one thing. Like, to have it disjointed is one thing, but to have it conflicted is...
Conflicted and not intentionally so.
Yeah, it's not like they went out of their way to...
You can have conflicting things if that's the entire point. But this was not the point. It's just, this is what we ended up with.
Right.
Which is
Well, I think that's
confusing.
Juxtaposition then, right? Like, if it's intentional, I feel like that's probably with the intent of juxtaposition rather than just, oh, this conflicts. It's usually, like, if it has that purpose behind it...
Right.
Yeah.
Right, it wasn't juxtaposition, or if it was juxtaposition, that was never communicated properly. And so, let's go back to just the score. Do you think the score effectively communicated the time period?
Like,
just
that's
not
such,
even...
That's such an out-of-the-woods, like, not even a consideration of this score for me. I don't think that... Because I just don't think that the score went for anything. I don't think this score went for a time period. I don't think it went for a sound, really.
Well, and like, I'm not specifically, was this 1930s music? Did this even create a specific time period that you could accept as being some kind of 1930s in an alternate universe? And
well, no.
For me, no. There was not any reason that this music was in this show beyond some producer thinking, oh, well, the kids want to hear rock, and we want some exciting music.
I just have a hard time with this show in general because I can't... Because that lack of muscle makes it so I have such immense difficulty trying to criticize it because I find criticism to be coming from a place from, like, you know, what did they go for and did they or did they not achieve it? Here, that's... I have trouble with musicals like this because I truthfully don't feel like anything was... gone for here, as much as, like, so, as big a statement that is.
I do think there were things that they did go for. I don't think it ever gelled. I think this conversation is then more, what could they have gone for that would have led to a better result?
I think occasionally the music succeeded at setting tone from, like, a setting perspective. Like, in terms of, like, the environment, like the vibes, like in terms of establishing the vibes of the scene, I think the musical was occasionally all right at that. There was one number I enjoyed in particular that they sung on the boat on the way to Skull Island. I couldn't, like, tell you how it goes or anything, but I thought it...
Who sang it?
It was the one boat hand who sung it principally, the one who sort of sounded like Adam Pascal.
I hated that song so much.
Yeah, I thought it was decent at evoking tension.
Pressure's Rising, I think it was called.
Nothing has really stuck with me. No details have stuck with me. I'm just left with sort of general strokes.
Well, I don't think there were any specific strokes that were written into the score. It didn't evoke a time period. It didn't really create effective character beats. It didn't communicate any plot information, and scores don't usually communicate plot information, but that's something it could have done and didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
The songs are there. They don't have much purpose, and they are bizarre in that you have Anne in Act Two saying, I won't scream for the money. And this is really where you get... The musical almost became Brechtian because she's singing, I won't scream for the money. And she's belting as high as she possibly can. And it's not the healthiest vocal sound. And she's in a King Kong musical, which, you know, is just a financial gambit to begin with. And she's literally screaming for the money, singing, I won't scream for the money. So the actress and the character at that point have completely separated. And you're like... Am I actually wrong here? Is this some kind of Brechtian masterpiece? And you realize, no, it's not, because that was just one moment, and that was not intentional at all. This was just dumb writing. How could you literally write, I won't scream for the money, and then write that vocal line? Did you not realize you're literally making her scream for the money? Like, these are the questions, and then just the lyricism. I could barely call it lyricism. Like, a good percentage of those lyrics didn't rhyme. And in the non-rhyming, it wasn't witty. And the few times the lyrics did rhyme, it was just the most obvious, banal rhyme that you could possibly think of. Like, what did you make of the lyrics?
Like, listen, I know already I've said, like, oh, I don't get what they're going for, I don't get, like, and said that for my lack of criticism. I feel like I could still talk about, like, technically thoughts on this score and about overall how it sounded and about, like, what tone they were going for, whether or not it was accomplished. I literally, like, even on a technical level, nothing for these lyrics. It was all
non-entity?
Hollow. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was a non-entity. I don't have thoughts about it. I don't. It was a flash in the pan.
Mm-hmm. So
I suppose they delivered melody lines. That's my thought about the lyrics.
But were they good melody lines?
Well, that's a score question. And not really.
The lyrics are a part of the score. Yeah, it's not good melody lines. The biggest issue here with the score, besides the completely obvious, and I think you would even agree with me, right? The completely obvious lack of any bit of professionalism.
Yeah.
Besides that, if you're doing a King Kong musical, and you come up with music that's this pedestrian, why are you doing the show?
For the production.
Yeah, but I mean, they never got around to why the show existed. They knew they wanted the production, but they never could find material that justified a reason for the show existing. And
yeah,
when it was
I share that sentiment.
When it was in Australia, there were like about 7 different composers.
Oh yeah, there's a real Maryland situation.
Yeah, and then they jettisoned most of this, from my understanding. Not completely sure. From my understanding, they jettisoned all about of. There were like 1 or 2 songs left from Australia when they came into Broadway. Mm. And so at this point, you've had about 7 composers from Australia. You had Jason Robert Brown who walked out. You now have Eddie Perfect. Why are we not finding a decent score somewhere? With all of those people working on it, like...
How are we still not coming up with it? It comes
down to bad producing. It comes down to a bad eye or a bad ear in this case. Because someone in there had to do something good. And you should have found that person and said, okay, get rid of everyone else. You're who we're going for.
Yeah. It's a lack of discernment, I guess.
Mm-hmm. A lack of discernment. And I guess at some point they did find Eddie Perfect and said, you are who we are going for, but his work is not... It's dime a dozen. There's no... You put on that music and you tell me who composed it. I got a list of about 250 names. And can't narrow it down at all. So, if there was a decision that Eddie Perfect was who they needed, that was a bum decision because it's not recognizable.
Yeah.
I do have to say, at this point, there has been a song that Jason Robert Brown released from his version of King Kong.
Is there?
He did, yeah. He did that concert. The concert is coming from inside the house, or I forget what it was called. With Shoshana and
Ariana Grande, yeah.
Ariana Grande, yeah. And they sing backup, and he sings it. And I don't know what the rest of the score was like. That song is effective at being a charm song that evokes the mood. And if the rest of the score was like that, I think they thought it wasn't exciting enough. And they wanted something that was just more rock and pop rock. But that was a wrong move. That was a wrong move because your score ended up communicating nothing. And whatever Jason Robert Brown would or would not have done with King Kong, he's a communicator. So, were there any musical moments that stood out to you?
I mentioned the one moment
on the ship,
yeah. There was also the girl boss number in Act 2.
Which one? Mm. There were about 3.
It was the one where she was like in the dressing room and she was singing this like, I have a voice and I am a woman, you know, like that one. I don't know. See, it stood out to me, but I couldn't tell you what the song was.
The thing that stood out to me on the score, and it's very, it's not even sophomoric, it's a freshman move, is you don't really know how to create a character, so the character is just going to refer to themselves in third person a lot.
Mm.
You're here, Anne, with a bag, Anne. Let's get them going, Anne. Everything's going to be fine, Anne. And it's... there was a lot of that. I messaged you, have a drinking game, drink every time she sings her own name. And you would have been passed out by the end of Act 1. You would have been on the ground screaming, no more, please.
Oh. What stood out for you in the score?
The first 30 seconds of the overture, and it wasn't a full overture, but before the actors came in, it started with like these spaced out open chords. They aren't even really chords, they're just the tonic and the fifth. I want to say.
Yeah.
And a number of them in rapid succession that were moving, and I was like, oh, is this a reference to the overture of The King and I? Is the show going to operate on this level? Because, like, King Kong, The King and I, that actually might be interesting. And, okay, the chorus of Hadestown is on, and we've dropped that, and we've now moved on to something else. Okay, I was wrong.
to a much lesser extent, that is very, very close to what he does with Beetlejuice. And Beetlejuice sounds a lot more Danny Elfman-esque, but it also starts with... Again, with just like these big dramatic chord stings, you know, sort of to set the entire piece. And immediately that I was like, okay, so is that just an Eddie Perfect trait starting the show with bum, bam, bum, like, you know?
But what are you trying to communicate with those chords then?
The show is about to begin.
We're going to be loud. Like...
Boom, show starts.
Yeah, I guess.
That's what it felt like to me.
Scream for the Money again got Brechtian in its disassociation with the plot and character. that stood out. And I was just so confused at the end. She was belting about Wonder, and none of the lyrics were landing, and I was like, does she even need to sing at the end to begin with? Which, I don't think so.
What a thing to say about the lead character in a musical.
No, because in the movie, he falls, Carl Denham walks up and says, 'twas beauty that killed the beast. And they had that line, but it was earlier, and so Kong died, but it was just like, why am I sitting here with her talking about Wonder, and what about Wonder? And the show kept referencing Wonder, but I didn't feel like there was a cogent point that I could understand. And listen, I'm someone who sat through Flying Over Sunset, and I was like, every second makes sense. I love this. We'll talk. You've probably heard about it at this point. We probably talked about it. I could make wild leaps for a musical and making it make sense to me. I could not figure out what it was trying to say about, oh, well, Wonder is man-made. Yeah, this musical is man-made. or Wonder is not man-made. Okay, well, we have a 30-ton puppet in the middle of the stage that was man-made. And so she's just belting about Wonder, and it was just like, is this some kind of, like, are there supposed to be Cirque du Soleil people on silks just wandering around? And we're just, oh, look at that. But then there was nothing visual. Maybe they just couldn't afford happening during the song. It was just confusing. Like, what was that last moment of the show for you? How was that the moment you landed on?
The thing that I didn't get there was... just, like, what's the tone of this? Is this supposed to be, like, regretful? Is this supposed to be pensive? Is this supposed to be some sort of, like, juxtaposition of smiling through pain or something? Like, what are you saying?
Right.
What is this communicating?
That's exactly what was missing for me. Great job at communicating that. I couldn't even think of that.
I am above Eddie Perfect.
I couldn't figure out what was missing there, but that's exactly it. There's just no tone.
If there's anything I'm known for on this podcast, it's being an excellent communicator.
Especially great communicators.
It's just generally like not even just is this successfully giving us anything. It's just is it giving us? What is it giving us?
And how is that the summation of the show?
Yeah. What does this have to do with King Kong the musical? Which is a question with not all, but a lot of the songs here. Just what does this have to do with King Kong the story and King Kong the musical?
Yep. So
there were like non-plot related songs, but like, you know, diegetically not plot related songs. Like there was the whole number for when they were rehearsing the show that the King Kong ape was supposed to be in, and you know, stuff like that. Sure, you get a pass. You're not really trying to tell a story there. This is set dressing of a song. Songs can be set dressing, but there were songs that weren't even that.
Mm-hmm.
just it's kind of boggling. Like, what are you, yeah. what are you doing?
I don't think they knew.
Yeah.
I hate to be wild. This person.
Do you?
Can you remember a worse score?
I honestly thought Diana was worse.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
At least I thought there were bad songs here that I found catchy. When there was a bad song in Diana, I thought it was actually ear grating. I'm thinking okay. about that pretty okay. girl song.
Mm-hmm.
And how that feels like every single inspirational Pasek and Paul number in a movie musical.
Yeah, but that, and that's we like, have that in this show, too.
We have that, sure, but that felt like most of the score of Diana for me.
Mm-hmm. I guess I could agree with you.
I enjoyed it a lot less. I guess I can't say outright worse or worse because I don't know necessarily what tactile things to compare it to, but I can say though this score did again beyond nothing for me. Like this just it just did nothing for me. It at least wasn't annoying about it.
You know what? I will disagree on Diana, because I think it does something that King Kong doesn't do. It at least tries to delineate character musically. Like,
true. Okay, true. Did it, true.
I don't think that it did it in the best
it
way.
Did,
but
I can
Camilla's
tell
material
you...
didn't sound like Diana's material.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you played
the most
a song
different,
for me,
but it was.
If
yeah.
you played like just the instrumental of the song, I will probably be able to tell you what character it was for. I can absolutely give you yeah. that. Like, what song mm-hmm. is a Queen Elizabeth song? What song is a Charles song? What song is a Diana song? Yeah. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I'll give you that.
So, technically, there is something it accomplishes. And the reason I bring up, can you remember something this bad? Because I can't remember a score that accomplishes so little.
Dance of the Vampires?
Even scores I don't like, they do something. And I just found this did nothing. Dance of the Vampires knew what it was, and the tone was consistent. And the tone yeah. was synonymous with the show.
Okay.
There is some character writing there. It's maybe not the best, but I mean, Krolok didn't sound like...
I guess, but, well, the only Max thing, I guess the only thing to compare it to then is, I guess, I don't know, something like SpongeBob, where the songs outright were not connected to character because the songs were... Because it's essentially a deceptive
review.
Jukebox musical.
Mm-hmm. But with SpongeBob, the
oh my God,
defense
are you about to
I will give...
SpongeBob?
The defense I will give in comparison to King Kong, they actually do try to accomplish a couple of plot moments in the
yeah.
music for SpongeBob.
Yeah.
They do try to have character moments that I think, on a whole, landed more than the attempts at character moments for King Kong.
Sure. Yeah, aside from those, I really don't think there's anything that we've covered on the podcast, at least, that
even not covering on the podcast. I'm trying to think through the entire Rolodex of my mind. I'm looking yeah. at my 300-some records thinking, is there anything here? I genuinely... I think this is, and I don't like to be outright negative, but this is the worst because it accomplishes the least. So that's the score, if
mm-hmm.
you can call it a score.
And that then brings us to book.
Yes. What did you think? You can't keep saying the same thing. You have to come
you
up
first.
With something
you
to
first.
Say.
You first.
I have a specific approach I want to take.
Uh-huh.
So you first.
Oh, God damn it. I was hoping you wouldn't say that was part of this specific approach. right. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay. I thought was going for trying to make Anne a strong female lead.
Yes.
And to sort of, you know, turn everyone else sort of related to this whole King Kong exploit, or I guess specifically just Carl, really, into, like, you know, greedy capitalist businessman takes this down and causes world ills because fuck capitalism.
While the entire enterprise is
extremely capitalistic, yes, of course.
The is the result of very bleak late stage capitalism. Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's you know, I guess it did those. Did it tell the King Kong arc story? Yeah. Did it establish those two characters as such? Yeah. Did I particularly care about anyone on the stage? No. Was I interested in anyone's safety or progress in this show? No. Did I feel any emotional attachment to any of the characters or any of the plot points of the story? No. I enjoyed this Lent character. That's pretty much the most that the book had me interested in.
Lumpy?
Yeah. Well, his name is Len, Dan.
Lumpy?
You'd know that if you'd listen to him once in a while. God.
Lumpy was a character that was added in 2006 because they wanted...
The Peter Jackson one?
Yeah, the Peter Jackson one, because they wanted to give Andy Serkis?
Serkis, yeah.
They wanted to give Andy Serkis an actual physical presence because he had done so much physical work for Peter Jackson.
Of course.
With having the final figure computerized. And he actually was playing...
And just generally for Peter Jackson's career.
And Andy Serkis was playing the King Kong movement, or was exemplifying King Kong movement for them during the making of King Kong. And so that character was... added at random for the kind of as a thank you to an actor. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that's one of the characters that remains. It is important in the show they ended up making, but really how I want to go about this is let's talk about the changes that they made.
Sure. Let me know what they were.
It always starts out with they arrive at Skull Island, and there are natives. And modern-day society, this can come off racist. So, there are no natives here.
Yeah, that much I at least got to that point in the movie, so I did notice that that was missing.
How they handle it is she's somehow, like, tangled in vines or something, which that doesn't completely work for me. But she ends up getting taken by Kong because she's caught in some vines.
You know, as
happens.
As it happens.
As one does. As one does. In all of the versions, there is usually a second male lead. So what happens is there ends up being a love triangle of sorts between the second male lead and Darrow and King Kong. And Anne Darrow really isn't interested in King Kong, but she's interested in the male lead. The male lead goes searching for her after she's taken by the natives. And they don't have this character because they don't want Anne Darrow to seem like a damsel in distress. They want to give Anne a lot of agency here. But you've ended up now there are three male characters, and there's not an interesting dynamic between the three. So she's not a damsel in distress. You accomplished that. I'm bored by the change overall. The result, because the character doesn't exist, is Carl Denham is not a capitalist who makes errors because of capitalism. He is someone that is, like, uber villain.
He's like, oh, snake oil guy and hates animals and women. I don't know.
What the romantic lead, I think, did that this musical proved that he did, because it wasn't there, is he's a balancing voice.
Hmm.
In all of the discussions of the show, he is some kind of balancing voice. And they don't even try and get Anne, which you're not going to try and save her, and you're just going to try and get the gorilla back. How are you getting King Kong back without her? And she, like, just randomly shows up. Oh, hey, Anne, you're alive. It just makes for awkward storytelling. So you show that he doesn't care about human life at all. Carl Denham doesn't care about human life at all. Well, in the original one, It wasn't that Carl Denham necessarily cared about human life. It was just that he made decisions based in capitalism that ended up having a human cost. And he wasn't always aware of that human cost. This guy, fuck everything. Money, money, money. So, it ended up being a bad thing that the character was removed. The next big change, they get in New York, and she goes down to where they're holding King Kong. They're rehearsing the show. She goes down and they, like, talk to each other. She tells him, oh, you have to fight. You have to fight. Get out of the chains, King Kong. And so what that unintentionally does, I mean, she runs off stage and a couple other things happen and he finally breaks free. But because she's the person that told him that he has to fight, and for some reason they can understand each other, all of the human life that is lost along the way of King Kong's destruction getting up to the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building, which one is it?
Empire State? I think it's the Chrysler Building, and I think, hold on, let me check.
It's the Empire State, because of, yeah.
Was it that here? The top of the thing looked like it might have been.
They didn't have licensing rights to make it a specific building here.
Right.
But all of the rampage, you've then had her unintentionally cause. So, yeah, Carl Denham has caused a lot of loss of human life. But she, the actions that she has taken have also caused that. And she is almost knowingly causing that at other times.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest change is she's not a damsel in distress. She's plucky. She's a go-getter. She's not going to let people get her down. She stands up to Kong when they first meet, which, that's bizarre to me. I'm sorry. Like, you see a 50-foot-tall gorilla and you're going to scream at him? How do you think that's going to end for you? That just makes her look dumb. And this show was produced right in, I mean, I hate to say it like this, it was produced right in the middle of the Me Too era. The Me Too era is ongoing. It's not a specific moment in time. We acknowledge that. It was a big thing in the press when the show was opening. And that is why they didn't want a damsel in distress. They got rid of the natives. They took a piece that is inherently problematic and tried to put all kinds of fixes on it. But with affixing so much agency to Anne, the other characters, including King Kong himself, lose agency to the point where you have one go-getter character and no plot.
It's looking at it from a 2018-ification lens and going just like, hey, how can we tell this story in the way that feels like it fits in 2018 without really specifically wondering, like, what does that do, I guess? Or I guess, what do we need to do to supplement that?
For me, it felt like they knew what blowback would exist if they went with the story as is. So they made a series of adjustments without also thinking through the ramifications for the adjustments they were making.
Yeah, I agree.
And this really gets to my larger overall point. For me, King Kong should never have been a musical. I don't think that's going to be a controversial statement.
Yeah, it's clear from this.
If you are going to put King Kong on the stage, it should have been an opera.
Hmm.
Because while King Kong didn't have to speak or sing, you could come up with a large amount of orchestral flourishes and storytelling through only music in a very intricate way. The fact that she is a damsel in distress. Okay, just about every soprano heroine in opera is a damsel in distress. And rather than a whole thing of, oh, we don't really want to make the actress scream 8 times a week, you turn the screams into bits of coloratura. And I think it is a mistake to try and modernize King Kong so much. I don't think the story works in a modern context, but also I don't think the story stands up to trying to adjust to a modern era. If you can't really do that, I think you choose an older art form where some of the lack of modernification, rather than being a problem, has been a feature of the works for at least 100 years.
That's a really interesting proposition.
I don't know who would take it on. I know Philip Glass did a whole opera based on Beauty and the Beast. I don't know if Philip Glass would ever have been interested in this. Someone in the vein of Philip Glass, though, I think might have been interesting. And then also, you are giving the piece a reason to exist musically.
Right.
I think a lot of the issues that you have inherent in the story would have partially been resolved by choosing a more archaic art format, and specifically an art format that does character beats through music. So the fact that King Kong can't talk and can't sing, there's still a fix.
Gives you, yeah, it gives you that dramaturgical reason, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Let's just cut the shit. This was a money grab.
Yeah.
And
it's a, I haven't gotten around to saying it, really, because I figured it's something we're going to go into with production, but...
Which we're going into momentarily, but go ahead.
Yeah, just ultimately the reason I felt like the material here was so non-present was because this was a theme park attraction. Like, it's not even a theme park show. This felt like an attraction. And it felt like them going, look at how much technical stuff we can do. There was no art being related here. There was no point the show was trying to get across. It's not saying anything. What it's doing is going, hey, we can do this lighting thing, and we can do this puppet thing, and we can do this thing with the stage. It's a theme park attraction. It's a Cirque du Soleil event. It's, you know, it's just spectacle. That's the reason it exists.
Well, then moving into the production, did the spectacle or level of spectacle justify its existence?
Justify? No. I'll flip it back and ask, do you think that it was successful as spectacle in general?
No.
What did you find successful?
King Kong's face.
I also thought that was successful.
But that's more of a talk about the puppet. Do we start with talking about the puppet? I guess you do start talking about the puppet because the production is a reaction to the puppet.
Fair enough. It's a great puppet.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a very good puppet.
I thought the face work was really something to behold. It's a very expressive face. I don't know exactly how they achieved that. I don't know if there was a person in the head operating all of that, or if it was computerized, but however they moved the face, that was excellent. The issue is, the puppet, by nature, is so big that it doesn't really move. I had this same issue with the off-Broadway revival of Little Shop that's currently running. By the time they got to the big Audrey 2, it kind of half opened its mouth, but not really. And you could more see the sides of the mouth moving than the front. Like, it became too big for its own good, or too big to be effective. And it's King Kong. I mean, the story is that it's a 50-foot gorilla. And you have to put that on stage. But it didn't move. The arms moved, but there were multiple people carrying each arm around. The head kind of moved. It really took to the very ending of the show where he starts running through New York, where I thought, finally, the puppet is moving like it should. And this works. Why was this not the rest of the show? Mm-hmm. The legs looked underdeveloped. Like, if this was an actual gorilla, no, those are not the legs. Like, there was no way the legs supported the weight of the rest. The arms looked very, very long, and I know that gorilla arms are already long anyway, but It just...
That's the body fair. Of the puppet. I guess I just wasn't even... I barely even clocked him. I guess I just wasn't looking, but like...
The body of the puppet for me didn't work. The head was supreme good work. The rest of the body... I mean, you even sent me a picture and said, scoliosis much? Because
the no, because mechanics... the back of the puppet has these like metal bars on them that the puppeteers use to like climb it that look just exactly like a back brace to me, and I don't. I thought that was funny.
As a puppet, it was both impressive and not enough. Did the puppet completely work for you?
I didn't like the lag. You know, the big clutter of it, you know, having to move so slow and being limited by those movements and how it sort of felt like. It did often feel like it was going at a snail's pace because, of course, you get a puppet that big, that's how it's going to go. But, you know, if the puppet immerses you, that is beyond excellent for me. The fact that the puppet in the first place was even, like, functioning is the spectacle. It is for the audience to sit there and go, ooh, puppet. That's what it's about.
But there were also, I don't know, you had the scene where the chorus girls were dancing in front of the curtain, and immediately you think, oh, a hand's gonna come out and grab one of the chorus girls from under the curtain and she's gonna be dragged off the stage. And that, I thought, was close to being a very effective moment. We never saw the hand. And sure enough, a girl did fall to the ground and scream as she was dragged off, but we never saw the hand. There were little things like that where, I mean, he picked up Anne, I think, at one point. We actually saw the puppet pick up Anne just that once.
No, they needed twice. Better hands.
It was too big for its own good.
Shoots itself in the foot.
Well, and then they had publicized that the puppet weighed about 3 tons. Literally, at least. Mm-hmm. And because it's so big, to get it on and off stage, they have to lift the entire thing with some kind of, I don't know what even kind of reinforcements. That's also something impressive. They have to lift the puppet up to get it off stage because there's nowhere to put it backstage. It has to hang over.
Right.
But in the lifting of the puppet, it also makes it less real.
Right. You can see it for the limp, lifeless, foam-filled thing it is.
Yeah. It's the Sunset Boulevard argument that we've talked about.
Right.
It's a terrific house set, and then it lifts, and you realize, oh, that's not real, that's a set. Mm-hmm.
It's taking too many cool things, putting them all on, not considering whether or not one cool thing will cancel out the other.
Mm-hmm. And just, I mean, the lag time to getting the puppet on and off stage just doesn't work. Just doesn't work. They did have... At one point, the hand went and reached for audience members in that the hand was carried out to the very edge of the stage and over to audience members, almost as if it was clutching them. That would have been very effective if you were sitting in the front of the orchestra.
So go full turn off the dark with it.
And that's the other thing that I haven't mentioned. I did see Spiderman turn off the dark on Broadway.
Sheesh. You're one of the survivors.
It was a school trip. It was not my choice.
I meant physically. You were one of the only people who wasn't harmed by Spider-Man turn off the dark.
I was thinking spectacle-wise, because writing-wise, I thought this show was on par with Spider-Man in that it was awful writing. Spectacle-wise, I thought Spider-Man delivered a lot more, because although there were flying machines that they were both on that were very apparent, it was interesting watching them fly around the entire theater, and there was an opening loom moment where there was a whole thing about Arachne and Arachne weaving her spider web, and there was a very effective moment where these dancers got on these pieces of fabric and started swinging out over the audience, and as they swung back, another piece of fabric shot up, and it created a loom. And that was the opening image. And you thought, oh, maybe this show will be good. And then it wasn't. But the effect was good enough that it gave you hope that the show would actually be good.
Right.
There were no effects here that I thought even gave that impression.
Shame, huh?
And while we are on puppets...
Are we going to talk about the other puppet?
There is another puppet.
There's one other puppet here. It's a little snake guy. A little serpent. A little legless lizard.
Mm-hmm.
And they fight!
Or so we're told.
It's,
There is always a fight scene in King Kong. It was a dinosaur. It was a dinosaur. It was a T-Rex in the original. It was multiple T-Rexes in 2006. It was more of a lizard snake-like thing in the 70s version. And they go with a snake here.
The snake bit King Kong's wrist twice. King Kong was dragged off stage. And then the snake was dragged off stage. And then we saw projection stills of the actual fight.
Mm.
That's what happened. Did you find it exciting?
No.
I did not find it exciting.
It was incredibly boring.
I liked it more in concept than in practice.
Yeah. Well, and I do wonder.
Same. Often.
Because... And I had to wonder. And just like that, I did have to wonder. If it was a T-Rex, the T-Rex would have had to be equal size to Kong, and I don't think they could have even fit another puppet of that size in the actual theater. So if you are stuck with this snake, I don't think the snake can really go around the puppet and the machinery and the actual ropes that are on the puppet. So then, does it not... It's going to necessitate a projection at a certain point. Do you go for a very intricate projection? And what happens is at the very start of the fight, does Kong scoop up and push her to the front of the stage? A whole drop of vines come down that the projection scene then plays off of. And at certain points of the fight, do we get bits of the snake being thrown through the curtain? Do we get Kong's hand being thrown through the curtain? Does the head of the snake come chomping at her and then Kong's hand pulls him back? Is that a more effective way to stage that fight?
So are you directing the first regional production of King Kong?
I would sooner die. But is that a better way to stage that scene?
Sounds interesting.
Because you're going to have the projection. I don't think there's a way around the projection.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess you get the jump scare of the puppets coming through the screen.
Right.
That is the way I would fix that personally. But that's me.
Well, I hope they're listening.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah. We all know how doting and devoted the producing team of King Kong is to hearing about the general public's thoughts about their show, especially this feels like the right time, 4 years out from that production. we are really, you know, who's this for, Dan? Like this just talking about the show for this long is making me get fucking existential. Who is this for? Who are the King Kong fans that are going out? Going to Spotify, going to Apple Podcasts, really looking to hear what people's thoughts are on King Kong the Musical.
Diana is one of our most listened episodes. Rags got a lot of listens, too. There are certain flop fans who would be interested in people's thoughts on a show.
Definitely, we are hitting the flop market. I just wonder if there are King Kong straggler fans out there. Maybe there's one person out there in the world who's just so fucking excited that we're talking about this right now, who is just so glad to see angry the conversations at us once, alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And then is angry just at us utterly crushed at what comes next. We are breaking someone's spirit.
But you know what
I
might
love this
happen?
Podcast so much, Dan. I'm so happy we do this.
You know what might happen? Someone sees there's a King Kong musical, they haven't heard about it before. They go to Spotify, they look up King Kong musical, and because there's no cast recording, guess what they're gonna find?
Ooh. Ooh. We're first up, baby.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh.
So, those are the puppets.
Those are the puppets, and then there's also, there is also a production.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think about the production? Go ahead, talk. You haven't talked much.
Well, I haven't talked much because I don't have much to say. And at least about the production, there is something physically tangible that I can look at and say, this happened. There was substance here because it physically happened in front of me. It wasn't a black box, though portions of this production were a black box, but it wasn't all black box. And shit happened, and some of the shit that happened was there were very, very technically impressive projections. And at one point, a whole bunch of the stage came up, and wasn't that cool when the stage came up. And at one point, the stage went down, and there was a hole in the stage, and there were stairs. Oh, no, wasn't that so cool? And,
the Hades Town Hall.
Yeah, the Hades Town Hall. There was lighting design too, and there were lasers, and the lasers made pretty cool effects. And sometimes the lighting design made it seem like there were bullets on King Kong, and I thought
the
lasers
from Carrie. It's like all the laser work that was pioneered by the original production of Carrie the musical.
There were the
showed up here,
up on the Bempire Tate building. I figured that's the copyright free. One that they're going for. There were the little bullet effects, and I thought that looked really cool. And oh gosh, wasn't it so cool, Dan? There were so many tricks and so much cool stuff. And they climbed at one point. There were vines that like got them tied up, and oh, it was so cool and great.
You liked the production?
Oh, it was so cool though, wasn't it? Like it was so cool. Like there were vines. Like the vines, like.
Are you
being
tangled
in the vines and
you sound
like,
sarcastic
and lasers.
God,
it's every fucking trick in the book. What do you like they just threw a bunch of shit on stage and went, hey, are you entertained? And everyone said yeah, and they said great, and that was King Kong. Like that's the point of the show. It's a fucking special effects show, and the special effects were well done. Cool. Those were cool. I can tell you how some of those are done, and I can tell you that's technically impressive. I can't tell you how some of those other things were done, and I think that's technically impressive. Well done, guys. You did some cool shit on the stage for 2 hours.
I disagree that they put a lot of shit on the stage, because if you looked at the sets...
Well, the sets themselves were pretty bare, but they... Maybe I shouldn't say they put a lot of shit on stage. They did a lot of shit on stage.
They did a lot of shit on stage. Fine.
Yeah.
There were no sets. And there were no sets because they had to have the puppet come in. And the puppet had to move to the extent that puppet did move. And what it rendered was we were constantly on a bare stage with a projection. Which just wasn't fun. And there weren't many vines. I mean, there was that tangle of vines that she got tangled in at the beginning. But, I mean, he's supposed to be in the middle of a jungle. And it's a jungle without a single tree. Was this a comment on global warming and how the animals in the future
are going to have to find different homes? Dan, I'm going to stop you right there. I do not want you digging into below surface level with King Kong. That's dangerous. We're not going to do that.
We're
not
going to
read it the subtext. This entire show, you know the one photo of the guy who's like, I know writers who use subtext and they're all fucking cowards? That's what I'm getting from this production.
I mean, it was a jungle without a single tree. That I did not understand.
Well, what do you do? What are you gonna do? You know, that's theater, baby.
Well, but the thing is, if you're making a spectacle, make a spectacle. Give me every visual thing you possibly can. And they came up with a puppet that was so big that they couldn't bring the spectacle.
Their own theatricality shot them in the foot.
And, again, no authorial voice. I also don't think there was really much direction happening, because while the pieces kind of moved on and off stage well, there was no discernible taste level.
It was a short attention span kind of show. It was flashing lights, and I'm good to turn off my brain and get some flashing lights sometimes. If the flashing lights are well done, go for it. You know, impress me. Put on some stunt shit. Like, I don't know. I'm not a Harry Potter fan in general. I've seen the movies. I think they're fine. I've seen clips of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. It looks like a cool experience.
As you will remember, in the third trimester of the Triwizarding Tournament, Harry Potter used the gillyweed and then went into the water, where he found that the Visvilliamus was very, very
bulbous. I think this is the closest we'll get to full synergy between you and Imelda Staunton. So I'm going to let it go for now. I'm going to let you keep going. Get it out of your system.
Synergy between me and Imelda Staunton.
This is the closest we're going to get. I got to take advantage of it now.
I don't know.
Lose it forever.
I don't know. We might have some thoughts about
True. I forgot that we are.
She'll be there.
Listener, stay tuned. Anyway, you know, there was a lot here that I found entertaining, and there was a lot that I thought came and went, and okay, you know, I would have paid $30-$40 for this on Broadway. I would have gone and done like, hey,
the issue is the production budget they set up for. They can't afford to have you only pay $30 or $40. They're doing badly if you can easily find a $30 or $40 ticket. They are doing very badly, and that is specifically why they had to close.
Do you think this show might have been better if there were less material?
Well, I said opera, which is inherently more material.
You either go way more material or way less material. Well, I guess technically there's like fewer words spoken altogether. Technically, an opera? I don't know. I don't know. Give us more fucking instrumental music. Give us some more of that. You know what? You know those touring shows that are like fucking like Jurassic Park live, and it's like in a stadium arena. It's like in the round, and it's like a bunch of actors' voice like lip syncing to pre-recorded tracks, and like big fucking remote-controlled dinosaurs come out. That's how you do this show. That's what this show, content dictates form. That's what the form of this show should be. Complete de-emphasis on material. You know, we know the myth of King Kong. We know how the story goes. Don't try. Just don't try. What you're here for is the King Kong puppet. Give us an experience that heightens that.
Both for this and Spiderman Turn Off the Dark, people were saying this show really should be an arena tour. They said that about, I believe they were working on an arena tour of the Lord of the Rings musical, which we have not discussed. I think the issue with Spiderman and with this is that those arena shows, you can only really do one or two nights, and to get the actual mechanics approved in each town and through a safety check, it becomes financially unfeasible.
Yeah.
But to cap off on Drew McErnie's direction, seeing Prince of Broadway, what I realized was how Prince was great at setting a taste level and he was a great editor.
Pause for a second. I'm so fucking tired that when you made the Prince of Broadway connection, I thought, oh, did he do that too?
Oh, Christ. Oh, oh baby. What I took away from that is how Prince is a great judge of talent. He's a great judge of material. He's great at setting a taste level, and he's a great editor. And where this failed direction-wise is there was not a taste level set up, and I didn't see the eye of a good editor. And then, wrapping up the production here, Drew McErnie was not only the director, he was also the choreographer.
Oh, is that the case?
Yes.
Huh.
And the choreography was actually what I liked most about the production.
Same. I thought it was very stylish.
Very stylish. Didn't necessarily focus the eye in the correct way, but I don't know if that was
possible. I thought it was, if anything, poorly implemented.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, also still looked good.
Yeah. I think this, it's not a show that lends itself to dancing, and yet he found places to dance and have the dancing look good. He choreographed that Jesus Christ Superstar tour you just saw.
Oh, did he?
Mm-hmm.
I rather liked his work on there. I thought it was pretty well suited to the production.
I guess I'll see. And so that is the production?
Yeah. And so this brings us to the video itself. We usually talk about how the video was shot. And What? What's up?
Well, there were some people on stage.
Are we going to have a section for that here?
We can't just completely skip it.
Okay, so in that case, I will lead it in the hopes that you have some points that I can jump off of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's start with Eric Lochtefeld, who played Len himself, a.k.a. Lumpy.
Credited as Lumpy.
Yeah.
Not Len.
But, you know, but it's a surprise in the show that he has a real name. I like to, you know, give him his due.
Well,
want to know a fun fact? I'm looking at information about the Melbourne run of this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not seeing anyone attributed to the character of Lumpy. I think that this character might have not been there originally.
Isn't that lovely?
This was someone added for Broadway.
Lumpy just wasn't part of Australia, but he was ready for Broadway.
I'll say in Melbourne, they did have characters such as Jack Driscoll.
That is the male romantic lead. I couldn't think of the name.
Yeah. There's also Captain Engelhorn / Chief of Police.
Okay.
And there was also an actress playing Cassandra / High Priestess.
Oh.
I'm so curious about that, whatever's going on there.
I think there's at least an audio bootleg of Australia.
Oh, there's a couple. There is a couple. Eric Lochtefeld as Lumpy.
Yeah.
How'd you like him?
Well, he has a scene at the end, and you think, Oh, there's an old man wisdom song coming from him, like, any second now. And it stays a monologue. So, points for not turning that into a song.
Yeah, thank you for sparing us.
And then it was a well-performed monologue.
I liked his acting.
Yeah, of the three defined characters in the piece, he did the best acting.
I found him likable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found him likable. He was good.
Great. Moving on. We've got Eric William Morris as Carl Denham.
Is he related to the William Morris Agency? And is that how he got representation?
Did you not like him?
Oh, I thought he was
fine. I thought you were implying the reason he was here because of nepotism.
He was yucky. You said snake oil salesman. He delivered that. What he had to sing, he sang well, even if I didn't like the music he had to sing.
Yeah. He got the overall, like, I think he got the character down.
Mm-hmm.
Did feel like there wasn't a lot of very brilliant nuance there, I suppose. He was good at he got the broad strokes successfully, but I think sort of fell short of the details, maybe. Now, for the character of Andero, we have Christiane Pitts. Can we quickly have the discussion about how her name is Andero?
Her name is Andero.
Yes, Andero. Yeah. We're both saying the same thing.
Darrow.
And Arrow.
The D is on the last name.
Yeah, the D's at the end of the... Yeah, and Arrow.
No, and Darrow.
We are saying the same thing.
You choose moments to be the stupidest motherfucker who's ever lived. You really do.
I choose them carefully.
Christiane Pitts. You actually had a review of her that you messaged me.
Well, I don't know if it's a her thing. I don't know if it's a director thing. That's part of the reason why I don't really have anything to... Because I can't pin it down to what it is. I will just say that this interpretation to me felt like the writing was meant to paint Anne as like this sort of sassy, headstrong, sort of like quippy person. And the performance itself was played very in earnest. And very without irony, which felt like it was directly at odds with some of the script sometimes. I'm not going to say that's her fault, because literally, I don't know.
She had a very large job in that, again, there's really no show, there's a character. And a lot of scenes she's sharing with a puppet. She delivers, she sings well, she's believable enough. I don't particularly agree with what they did for the character, but she's asked to make a lot of heinous writing palatable, and she does that. She does not let the show down ever, which is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's the things around her that let the show down, and it's the actual writing. She is never the problem.
Yeah. Overall, it's an energetic company. Thought the ensemble was particularly hardworking.
The ensemble worked very hard, yes. And you're overshadowed by that puppet. And that. Can you imagine what it's like to be in that show?
Yeah, well.
To have to go out there 8 times a week and hear that music and try and put that over, and the audience is dwindling.
You get golf claps for busting your ass.
Which is a good segue to the video.
Mm.
Namely, this audience. We're talking about this audience.
Have you ever, in a bootleg, seen so many people walking out? Have you ever?
You do see people walking out in the middle of the show.
Like, mostly throughout the second act. I'm amazed they stuck around. But, like, it felt like as soon as the second act began, people were booking it.
Those are, I have to use the restroom in the middle of the show. You're gonna get one or two of those in a show. There were a large number of people that got halfway through Act 2. And
yeah, what are the odds of all of them?
They're not coming back.
Yeah.
Because
I have to use the bathroom over at, over at the McDonald's.
Yeah.
Over at the Shake Shack.
You would see them coming back. And we saw a lot of people get up in the second act, and for some reason, although they were pictured getting up, they were never pictured coming back. But I mean, that opening number worked so hard. Whether it was good work or whether it was bad work, the performers, the writers, everyone was pulling out all of the stops in that opening number to try and make it seem like a hit. And the opening number ended, and you heard the audience... Devastating. Devastating.
Ow. But what can you do? You're sabotaged from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
It just sucks. Like, you know, poor them.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
And the video, then, itself.
I mean, it's pretty well shot. It's a hard production to capture because there's a lot of dark and there's a lot of sudden blackouts. And, you know, every time that there's a sudden blackout and then the lights come back, there are two or three times where it takes you about 5 seconds to refocus.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, generally, no problems.
Yeah, I mean...
It's a good capture.
The color level... Not the color levels, but the brightness levels are fluctuating because the production is fluctuating. But it captures...
There's so much a recorder can do.
It captures the action perfectly.
Yeah.
And it never closes up too much that you're missing things.
Well done, guy.
Yeah.
Out of everyone here, I think the person who's
worked, person who did the I best most work.
Respected yes. was the person filming this bootleg.
I agree. I agree.
God, we're fucking awful.
So, we end every episode with a grade.
Well, we grade the video. Video first. Video
yes,
is...
Yes, we grade the video.
A minus.
It's an A minus, knowing that probably anything better was impossible.
Yeah, exactly. The A minus is probably, like, I don't know, unless you get someone really, really, really goddamn on their game, it'd be hard to get a solid A with this show.
I don't think you could even get on the game. It would really have to be the theater had adjusted the brightness levels themselves to get a better capture.
Right.
Because they knew someone was recording. That's the only... That's the only negative we found with the video, and that's not... I don't see how they could have done better there.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to the show...
The show is an F. The puppet is a B. That brings me, I think, to a D minus.
I'm gonna give it a D plus. Because I think it fails as a show. I think it is a failure. Mm-hmm. But the plus is because, yeah, I feigned attention. I was very distracted. But I thought there were cool effects. And every now and then I was like, oh, that looked cool. Maybe if I were in the theater itself, I would have found the production more entertaining.
Maybe if you were in the front seats and Kong's hand came right up to you, you'd probably feel better about it, but...
The plus is because, yeah, this is... There are entertaining things here.
Oi. Oi, Joshy.
It hurts.
You know, when I see shows that are not good, I text people, I message people about what I see... Yeah. And someone said, sounds like an awful night. And I said, you know what? No, because you have to see some bad shows to know what shows are good.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. Show.
Sometimes, mm-hmm. I hope you won't mind me saying this, Dan. Sometimes we talk about what we're going to discuss on the podcast. And sometimes it comes down to, should we talk about this show? Or should we talk about this version of this show? And especially when it comes down to like a version of a show... We'll usually get around to, no, this version of the show sucks. And my argument is usually I'm not afraid to talk about things that suck on the podcast. I don't have to like everything. I'm probably not going to like everything. But like even beyond that, I'm not afraid to talk about stuff that objectively is pretty bad. And I think it's episodes like this that help us, you know, find appreciation for the shows like Rags, as you mentioned earlier, and... Three Tall Women and A Little Night Music and Cabaret and La Cage, you know? It's shows like this that show you how fucking hard it is to make theater and how you really have to give a shit about what you're making because otherwise you fall into this trap. And if you go first with, oh, this would be cool to stage, if your concept is as hollow as that, the show will feel as hollow. And then mm-hmm. you're just wasting everyone's time.
Well, the reason, specifically, when it comes down to a version of a show and I say this doesn't work, well, that's because our podcast is finite. We do, at most, what, 52 episodes a year? And we'll probably only be covering these shows once. So I feel like we should give each of the shows their fair shot. I think it's fair to say there will never be a revival of King Kong. If you're giving King Kong a shot, this is it. And I don't mind covering bad shows as long as there is discussion to be had. And I've brought it up before. I don't like that show. I don't oppose doing it, but I don't have anything to say.
Mm-hmm.
So being honest, audience... We have very long conversations about what shows that we select, and
we put so much fucking work into this for you guys, you ungrateful bastards. You could like the, you could review the podcast.
I'm not trying to. It would help us if you posted a review. I'm not trying to be angry with the audience. I'm just saying there is a whole calculus that goes on behind the scenes and with what we end up picking. This, we wanted to talk about puppets. And this was the biggest puppet on Broadway, probably ever.
Yeah. Again, I lightly mentioned it, but this show won a Tony Award. This is the Tony Award-winning King Kong musical. Because
special non-competitive Tony Award.
Tony Award-winning.
Well, the puppetry was kind of inventive, broke new ground with what puppetry could do.
Exactly. And so, from that perspective, I thought, hey, that'll be an interesting conversation. And, well, we got the rest of it, but, you know, can't believe I'm saying this. I'm glad we talked about King Kong.
I saw King Kong, and I can say that now moving forward.
Right. Yeah.
And now, next week.
Yeah, segue this. I dare you. Find a parallel. Go ahead.
And as everyone remembers, King Kong had not a score, but they claimed that music was done by Eddie Perfect. Also, a show that didn't have a score, but had music that they claimed was by Eddie Perfect, was Beetlejuice. Mm-hmm. And that played at the Winter Garden. And it was a shame that that show dishonored the Winter Garden, where Barbara Streisand did Funny Girl. And while we are not discussing Funny Girl, we are discussing Barbara Streisand's other musical, I Can Get It For You Wholesale. Only she's
such
not in it.
Fucking web.
Because Barbara Streisand, there are bootlegs. There are video bootlegs of I Can Get It For You Wholesale, the original
Holy
production.
Holy shit,
we're talking
Dan.
About I Can Get It For You Wholesale, done by the American Jewish Theater in 1991.
Dan, what are you doing? Fuck.
You challenged me. I made the connection.
You made seven different connections. I asked you to
six
segue,
degrees.
Not play 6 degrees.
6 degrees. It's Kevin Bacon.
Christ almighty. That
you
was,
want me to take us to Kevin
out.
Bacon?
Pause on that for a moment. We'll touch base on that in a second. Yeah, we're going to talk about I Can Get It For You Wholesale. Why?
Because we should. Because we should.
Sure. Yeah, we're going to talk about this little musical. Next week, we're talking about this title off-Broadway production, which will be fun. Wholesale. It's about selling things whole. I'm extremely knowledgeable.
You're selling
about
your whole.
Show. Okay. We're
That's
gonna,
not something
we're gonna
you want
see
on
you,
the podcast.
We're going to see you next week.
Like,
we're going to see
ahead,
you next week, folks.
Go ahead
we're gonna,
sell it and have fun.
Okay. Dan.
If you can't sell it, you'll keep
Dan,
sitting on it.
Dan. Mm-hmm. Dan.
Yeah.
Wish our listeners good night, please.
Good night, listeners.
Okay, so now what's this Kevin Bacon thing? How are you going to get us to Kevin Bacon?
If you enjoyed the episode, rate us, review us, and subscribe to us on your platform of choice.
And if you have any recommendations, questions, or virtual flowers to send our way, email us at unccpodcast@gmail.com.
The Unauthorized Critics Circle podcast is unauthorized. The podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
King Kong!
And all names, pictures, and audio clips are registered trademarks and or copyright of the respective trademark and copyright holders. The Unauthorized Critics Circle cannot help the listener locate or distribute the recordings discussed herein.
Okay, so now what's this Kevin Bacon thing? How are you going to get us to Kevin Bacon?
Oh, are we still recording?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see. I'm not that familiar with the Kevin Bacon filmography.
Hey,
I
you know, made
guess...
your bed, lie in it.
Yeah. Oh, so Barbara was in I Can Get It For You Wholesale with Elliot Gould. Elliot Gould was in Friends. And, That should get me somewhere. What was Kevin Bacon? I knew he was in Footloose.
No Googling allowed. No Googling
I'm
allowed.
Not Googling. I am not Googling at
Good.
All.
Good. Okay. You just have to sit and think.
Yeah. God, I really don't watch much Kevin Bacon. He was in Will and Grace. Okay, I think I have something there. Let me take it to back to I can get it for you wholesale. Oh, well, you know, I mentioned Barbara. She's in I Can Get It For You Wholesale. She was also in Funny Girl, as we all know. Funny Girl. There was a concert that was done in 2003 where Kristen Chenoweth sang I Am the Beautiful Reflection of My Love's Affection. And Kristen Chenoweth was in Promises, Promises with Sean Hayes. Sean Hayes, of course, was in Will and Grace. Kevin Bacon was a guest star on Will and Grace, and that's one of the only Kevin Bacon things I've seen in my life. Okay, I'm not a huge Kevin Bacon fan. When I play
you
this...
You have no connection to Kevin Bacon, and yet still, when... you made that within... Was that six? I think that's within six.
Yeah, that is within six. When I play this, I play 6 Degrees to Bob Fosse, not Kevin Bacon, and I never lose.